You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our second of two podcasts on non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, hosted by Med Learning Group. This series is designed for community-based oncologists, hematologists, pharmacists, and other members of the multidisciplinary oncology care team. In this episode, we'll be talking about the role of bispecific antibodies and discussing some clinical outcomes from key trials in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma management. My name is Vaidehi, and I will be the host of today's podcast. Joining me once again is Dr. P. Connor Johnson. Dr. Johnson is the attending oncologist at the Center for Lymphoma, Massachusetts General Hospital, and instructor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School located in Boston, Massachusetts. His research focuses on addressing the supportive care needs and mitigating the therapy toxicity of patients with lymphoma, patients receiving cellular therapy, and lymphoma survivors. He conducts studies and clinical trials of interventions to improve patient quality of life and therapy tolerability. Dr. Johnson, thank you for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me, Vi.
In our last podcast, you introduced us to bispecific antibodies. Could you share some of the clinical data from key trials for these agents? How about we start with odronextamab?
I'd be happy to. And I think this is an important class for us to review, as there are now four different bispecific antibodies, all targeting CD20, CD3 in late phase clinical development. And I think these are poised to be useful off-the-shelf options in the near future for our patients. Odronextamab is given intravenously. It's initially given as a split dose for the first 2 weeks, and then it's a weekly infusion for 12 weeks, and then given every 2 weeks indefinitely until progression or until there's a toxicity requiring discontinuation. It's been evaluated in a phase one study of patients who are mostly older adults, mostly who've had DLBCL, but patients also could have low-grade follicular mantle cell lymphoma. The response rates for patients with DLBCL was about 39% in those without a prior CAR-T and 33% with those with a prior CAR-T, with about a quarter of each of these subsets having complete responses. In follicular lymphoma, the response rate was actually 78% with a complete response rate of 63%. And perhaps most importantly in this study, the toxicity profile is manageable. The main toxicity of concern is cytokine release syndrome, and that occurred in 61% of patients, but almost all of which was grade 1 or 2.
I believe glofitamab has also shown promising results for both the refractory and relapsed DLBCL as well as other NHLs. Could you share some of the data on glofitamab?
Indeed, you're right. Glofitamab is also given intravenously. It's been evaluated in a phase two trial that incorporated different subtypes of aggressive B-cell non-Hodgkin lymphomas, relapsed after at least two prior lines of therapy. The way glofitamab is given is first a single dose of obinutuzumab, a CD20 monoclonal antibody, is given as a pretreatment, and then it's given in step-up dosing weekly for the first cycle. A cycle is every 21 days, and so beginning with cycle two, full dose 30 milligrams is given, again, once every 21 days for up to a total of 12 cycles. So this is a time-limited regimen. In this study, this phase two trial, the median age of patients was 66 years with a median of three prior lines of therapy, and the response rate was 51.6% with a complete response rate of nearly 40% and a median duration of response of 18.4 months for glofitamab as a single agent. I'll note that the toxicity profile was manageable. The rates of cytokine release syndrome were 63%, but almost all were grade 1 or 2. And other than cytokine release syndrome, cytopenias were the most commonly seen toxicity. Glofitamab's also been given in other subtypes of non-Hodgkin lymphoma in a separate study. In this study, there was a cohort of patients with indolent B-cell non-Hodgkin lymphomas. And in this cohort, the response rate was 81% with a complete response rate of 69%. And many of these responses, particularly the complete responses, were durable.
You mentioned that epcoritamab and mosunetuzumab are the other two bispecific antibodies in late phase clinical development. Can you share some of their key data?
Absolutely. And epcoritamab and mosunetuzumab are both given in a subcutaneous formulation, which is a little bit different than odronextamab and glofitamab. For epcoritamab, it's been evaluated in large cell lymphomas in a expansion cohort. In this trial, all patients had to have two or more prior lines of therapy. And epcoritamab is given at 48 milligrams weekly for three cycles, every 2 weeks for cycles 4 to 9, and then every 4 weeks beginning with cycle 10. And this is given indefinitely until progressive disease or a toxicity requiring discontinuation. In this study of patients with large B-cell lymphomas, where the median age was 64 years and the median prior lines of therapy was 3, the toxicity profile was quite favorable, with less than half of patients having cytokine release syndrome, almost all of which were grade 1 or 2. And the response rate was 63%, with a complete response rate of 39% and a median duration of response of 12 months. And particularly for complete responses, those responses could be quite durable. And responses were seen in those who were CAR T-cell naive and those with prior CAR T-cells. Epcoritamab has also been used in some patients with other histologies in a phase 1-2 study, which identified 48 milligrams as the recommended phase 2 dose. In the set of patients with relapsed refractory low-grade follicular lymphoma, the response rate was 90% with a complete response rate of 50%. And all toxicities in this study were grade 1 or 2 with respect to cytokine release syndrome. Mosunetuzumab, again, is another subcutaneous formulation bispecific, and it actually already has approval in Europe and we're expected to have approval in the near future in the United States, potentially in the next calendar year. For mosunetuzumab, in a phase 1-2 study comparing two step-up dosing schedules, the rate of cytokine release syndrome with a 5-45-45 step-up schedule was less than 15%, so a favorable toxicity profile. It's given in step-up fashion. So for the first cycle, the dose is steadily escalated and a cycle is every 21 days. And then beginning with cycle 2, full dose is given. And the number of cycles depends on a complete versus partial response, up to 17 cycles. In a study of patients who had DLBCL, other aggressive B-cell non-Hodgkin lymphomas, low-grade follicular lymphoma, and even some patients with mantle cell lymphoma, the response rate for the aggressive non-Hodgkin lymphoma cohort was 29.4%, whereas it was 81.8% in patients with indolent histologies, including a complete response rate for that cohort of nearly 64%.
So it really looks like bispecific antibodies will be a great addition to the NHL drug arsenal. Do you think these are likely to replace currently available therapies in the future?
I think bispecific antibodies will be a very important addition to our treatment armamentarium in the near future. And I think the story is yet to be fully written for where they will land in our overarching landscape. I think the most likely early approvals will be as single agents in follicular lymphoma and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. But there's really a number of different exciting clinical trials ongoing, which are looking at combination strategies across the continuum of different points of the treatment paradigm. For example, there's even upfront studies going on in follicular lymphoma and combination upfront studies in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma.
How safe are these drugs? Can you tell us about adverse events that have been observed in these trials?
And that's a critical question, of course, as with all therapies. The major toxicity of concern with bispecific antibodies is cytokine release syndrome. And that's because these are T-cell mediated strategies where you're targeting CD20 and CD3. And much like we see with CAR T-cells, there can be an IL-6 mediated cytokine release syndrome that can be significant. When we think about high-grade cytokine release syndrome, we think about grade 3 or grade 4 toxicity. And I think reassuringly, the vast majority of events in these trials are grade 1 or grade 2 and are manageable with appropriate identification and treatment, sometimes which requires tocilizumab if the grading is high enough, which is an IL-6 receptor antibody.
How do these toxicities compare to those seen with agents from other drug classes?
Yeah, and that's a great question as well. Some overlap and some are very distinct. So for example, as we talked about with glofitamab, the second most common set of toxicities besides cytokine release syndrome was cytopenias. And that mirrors what we see although they're not identical, it's at least something we're familiar with chemotherapy, CAR T-cell therapy, and targeted therapies such as lenalidomide or BTK inhibitors. What's unique about bispecifics is indeed cytokine release syndrome, which requires distinct identification and management. And is a unique toxicity to bispecifics, with the exception of this is also seen with CAR T-cell therapy, being another T-cell mediated treatment.
How would you go about managing these toxicities in your patients?
Yeah, and I think with that, it's probably helpful to go through a few novel agents and to summarize some of their toxicities. One novel class of agents are antibody drug conjugates in DLBCL. Two of those antibody drug conjugates are polatuzumab vedotin and brentuximab vedotin. They have different targets, but the same chemotherapy payload, which is monomethyl auristatin E. And because of that, which is a microtubule inhibitor, peripheral neuropathy is the most common toxicity. And so dose reductions are the typical strategy, but also therapies such as gabapentin and pregabalin can be employed for painful neuropathy. Obinutuzumab is a CD20 monoclonal antibody associated with higher rates of infusion reactions than rituximab, another CD20 antibody. And so pre-medication with antihistamines and corticosteroids are an important strategy for obinutuzumab. Lenalidomide is an agent that's used in multiple different areas of oncology. It's an immunomodulatory agent, typically associated with cytopenias, but also can be associated with augmented risk of venous thromboembolism. And in lymphoma, prophylaxis with aspirin is typically employed to mitigate this risk. Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitors are now available for relapsed refractory mantle cell and are available in certain subtypes of DLBCL. There's unique cardiac toxicities of BTK inhibitors, which are atrial fibrillation and hypertension. And so multidisciplinary management with cardiologists and primary care physicians can be important for trying to control, appropriately manage these toxicities and ensure that patients can stay on therapy. Loncastuximab tesirine is another antibody drug conjugate, but it has a different chemotherapy payload than polatuzumab or brentuximab. And that chemotherapy payload yields an edema or capillary leak type of syndrome, which can manifest as pleural effusions and requires corticosteroid prophylaxis with each infusion of lonca. And lastly, we've talked about bispecifics, but also CAR T-cell therapy has risk of cytokine release syndrome, similar to that of bispecifics in respect to how it manifests. And it also can be managed with tocilizumab, with or without steroids. And then also CAR T-cells can yield neurologic toxicity, cytopenias that persist, and B-cell aplasia. For neurologic toxicity, we typically employ corticosteroids as the primary treatment.
For our listeners, could you share some of the important things you've learned in practice over the last few years and even throughout your career when it comes to identifying and managing patients with NHL?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd say that's perhaps the question. I think one little tidbit that I want to mention is that sometimes it can be challenging to assess fitness for therapy, and how we understand fitness for therapy can really evolve over time. As an example for this, for DLBCL, our most common non-Hodgkin lymphoma, the typical paradigm for treating in the relapsed refractory setting is to assess fitness for transplant, salvage chemotherapy in a transplant. And though that's somewhat changed over time, for the most part, typical age cutoffs are used to evaluate that. But with the emergence of CAR T-cell therapy, how we understand fitness of CAR T-cells, which is a potentially curative strategy, is really evolving. And the bar for what it means to be fit is really very different from that of transplant. So I think trying to develop an ongoing understanding of what it means to potentially be fit or someone who can tolerate the toxicities of therapy is really something important to pay attention to, because we don't want to necessarily omit a potentially curative therapy for patients. I think the other thing I'll note when it comes to managing patients with non-Hodgkin lymphoma is just that it's humbling the broad array of presentations and therapies that we have available. And that's the latter is one of the exciting things about non-Hodgkin lymphoma. But I think it's just always a humbling experience to know that there's a vast array of presentations and now an ever-growing array of different therapy options for our patients, which is a challenge for us to continue to learn and develop.
Talking of fitness, how much does mental fitness or societal kind of support, how much does that play when you decide a particular therapy option for a patient?
And that's really, it's a critical question, because I think it depends on the therapy. And that's part of how we continue to understand what it means to be fit for a therapy, and also part of how we try to eliminate potential disparities in access to therapies. We do understand, for example, with CAR T cells, we do need for patients to have caregivers who can monitor for neurologic toxicity, particularly in the first 30 days post CAR T cell. And so trying to have an understanding of the capacity to do that safely is part of being able to deliver CAR T cells in a safe, effective manner. So it's our challenge of our healthcare system to try and improve, number one, how we identify fitness for CAR T cells, and number two, how we create systems in place to try and support patients and maximize the access to CAR T cells across the board.
I think we have time for just maybe if you could share one case study with us with your experience on treating a patient with CAR T cell therapy, that would be great.
Absolutely. So I'd like to share an example case. This is a 70-year-old woman who presented with dyspnea and a cough. She had a chest x-ray that showed a pleural effusion, multistation adenopathy on the chest x-ray, which is confirmed with additional imaging. A biopsy was performed, which revealed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, non-GCB subtype, which is a subtype of DLBCL. And this was not a double hit lymphoma. So this is a regular diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. She actually enrolled on a clinical trial and got polatuzumab vedotin, the antibody drug conjugate we mentioned before, in combination with RCHP, and had a complete response. But she did relapse 2 years later with lymphadenopathy and actually got second line therapy with a salvage chemotherapy regimen called Argemox. She unfortunately did, though she did have a partial response, quickly progressed within 2 months of therapy. So now she's someone who is status post two lines of therapy with consideration of what to do next. And so this is a patient who CAR T cell therapy is the standard of care in the third line or later setting for diffuse large B cell lymphoma. So this patient actually received lisocabtagene maraleucel, which is liso-cel. And there are three different CAR T cells that are approved in this setting: liso-cel, axi-cel, and tisa-cel. All have shown impressive responses in the third line or later setting. And there's durable remissions or cures on the order of 40% of patients. Particularly, and liso-cel and axi-cel now have approval in the second line setting for primary refractory or early relapsing disease, which is less than 12 months from initial therapy. So this patient actually achieved a complete response and remains in ongoing remission. And she was fortunate and had no cytokine release syndrome or neurologic toxicity. And so I think is a good illustration of one example where CAR T cells can be used.
That's great. Thank you very much, Dr. Ron Johnson. It's definitely an interesting time for NHL management, and it's a relief to be able to offer patients several options to manage their NHL. This has been an excellent podcast series on the identification and management of NHL, and I hope our listeners are able to apply what they've learned from you. That's it for today. Once again, thank you, Dr. Johnson, for sharing your knowledge and taking the time to discuss the clinical outcomes of bispecific antibody treatment in NHL. And thanks to all our great listeners for joining. As a reminder, this is the second of two podcasts in this series. So if you haven't heard the first one, I invite you to have a listen. MedLearning Group offers many other types of CME programs as well, which I invite you to explore. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Have a nice day.